Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to look at some interesting facets of consumer psychology, product engagement, and also ways to keep yourself away from distractions. You probably guessed who we have with us today. Yes, the one and only Neer Eyal, who is one of my favorite people from the world of consumer psychology and product design. He is most known for his book, Hooked, which was all about developing products that are intentionally habit-forming. He's also famous for the antidote of Hooked, titled Indistractable, which helps us cultivate an understanding of how our minds direct our behavior and form activity patterns over time. In fact, Indistractable received critical acclaim, winning the 2019 Outstanding Works of Literature Award. Neer is also formerly a lecturer in marketing at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and he has also taught at the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. If you are a regular listener of this show and are in the world of tech, there is almost no way that you haven't heard of Neer. With that, Neer, this is your prime time. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy that you're here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for that beautiful interruption. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my absolute pleasure as well. Right, so let's get started. I'll start with something that I admit might sound a little controversial. I listened to your interview with Ezra Klein, and I agree with you for the most part, where you said that you can't really expect tech companies to make mediocre products because that's counterintuitive to human progress. But let me play the devil's advocate here and piggyback on one of Ezra's arguments, because I think there are lots of other people who think that the big tech is out there to get them. Take the Social Dilemma documentary on Netflix, for example. Or you also have people like Tristan Harris, who claim that tech companies are deliberately rewiring our brains, making us buy things we don't want, manipulating election results, so on and so forth. So even if not for making us addicted in the pathological sense, would you agree that the big tech club is highly manipulative and that they are turning us into puppets on a digital string of sorts?
Well, that's a very, very leading question. I don't know. You know, when you have a question that has the implicit allegations in the question, it's almost impossible to reply. You know, it's not a good faith effort. I have to say, with all due respect, because you've leveled all these claims without much evidence, frankly.
Right,
you know,
right.
This is the exact problem, that we have been brainwashed into thinking, because of this moral panic that is perpetuated by movies like The Social Dilemma, that is perpetuated by, frankly, old media that is terrified of new media, that is perpetuated by our desire to blame something outside of ourselves for all our problems. And this is exactly what's happening yet again. This has happened with every new technological development. The knee-jerk reaction is always to blame the stuff outside ourselves. In my generation, it was the television. Before that, it was the radio and the comic book, all the way to the written word. Socrates talked about how the written word was this terrible technology that was going to enfeeble men's minds.
Right.
So let's back up a second and have some historical precedents, that the record of freaking out about technology as the source of all our problems is really bad, really bad. With that, we have to take a step back. We have to, you know, zoom out a bit and realize that, look, all forms of media are designed to manipulate you. I mean, wake up. This podcast, my voice, your efforts, the news media, the cable television networks, the papers, everybody wants your attention and wants to persuade you. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That can be a very positive thing. This is how we exchange ideas, how we learn about our world, how we connect with others, and how we persuade each other to make things better, hopefully. That's the whole purpose of free speech. Now, for many entrenched parties, a world where individuals have access to others in a decentralized manner, as opposed to a centralized, you know, CNN news network type of fashion where you have to own the airwaves or own a newspaper to get your message out, that is incredibly scary to people, especially entrenched media interests. And I understand that. And it does come with some negative repercussions. Sometimes you have people who are really wrong saying really dumb things on the internet. But it also offers us an upside that when you think about how much benefit there is to a world where people do have access to communicate a message, when they can blow the whistle and hold power to account and say sometimes crazy ideas that turn out to be correct, that's a wonderful thing. So was it Voltaire who said that I may not like what you say, but I will die for your right to say it.
Wow.
That we need this interchange of ideas. It's a very good thing. And yes, that means that 99 times out of 100, people will say stupid stuff. But that one time that somebody says the truth, I personally don't want to live in a world where they don't have access to these technologies, where they are somehow censored by people who think they know better. I think that's a very dangerous slippery slope, to be honest.
I absolutely love this point of view. You know, it makes a lot of sense. And to clear things up, can you also debunk and help us understand as to what is the difference between being manipulated versus being addicted versus what someone would probably call as just overuse of something in their own volition?
Yeah, this is a really great question because we tend to toss around this term addiction on everything, that these days everything is addictive, right? That, if I like playing video games a lot, then I'm addicted to video games. Yeah. If I like social media or television, oh, I must be addicted. And it's a terrible use of this term. You know, an addiction is a pathology.
Yeah.
It is not something that should be taken lightly. It is not something that we throw around. The other day my wife got a box of shoes from a company that printed on the box, danger, addictive contents inside. I'm talking about shoes, okay? And it just goes to show you, I mean, addiction is a pathology. What are we doing talking about things as if they are addictive? You know, an addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. We're not injecting Instagram. We're not freebasing Facebook. We're not snorting Snapchat here, people. Come on. Get a grip. They are apps on your phone. They are not drugs in your brain. And anybody who tells you that dopamine this and squirts of chemicals in your brain doesn't know what they're talking about. It's not even close. You know, the amount of dopamine that's released in your brain from playing a video game is equivalent to having a candy. It's not cocaine. It's about, thousands of times less than any kind of drug. And so comparing these things to addictions is, for the vast majority of people, ridiculous. Now, some people, and this is very important, some people do get addicted to various forms of technology because people get addicted to all kinds of things. People get addicted to sniffing glue. People get addicted to eating paint. People get addicted to all kinds of things, alcohol. But look, not everybody who uses these things is addicted to them. You can have a glass of wine or beer with dinner. Not everyone who has a drink is an alcoholic. Not everyone who has sex is a sex addict. Come on. Now, not everybody who uses social media is addicted to social media. Give me a break. Yep. Some people are, though. Right? Some people really do have the pathology of addiction, and we can talk about why we should protect them. It's about 1% to 5% of the population. They deserve special protections. Also, children deserve special protections, and we have laws on the books to protect children because, look, any form of media needs to, or all sorts of things, not just media, all sorts of things need to be mediated when someone is not of proper state of mind and body. So, I wouldn't let my 13-year-old walk into a library and just read any book because a 13-year-old little girl is not ready to read just any book. There's a lot of books out there that she's not ready for.
Right.
Right. I wouldn't let her go into a casino and start gambling and blackjack or walk into a bar and order a gin and tonic. She's not ready at 13 years old. And so we have restrictions on what our children can do with technology as well. And I think that's great. We should uphold those laws and, if anything, strengthen those laws. But if you're not pathologically addicted and if you're not a child, leave us alone. We don't need the government stepping in and telling us every 30 minutes, hey, you know, stop using Twitter here, which is exactly what Senator Hawley's bill in the United States wants to do to using social media. I don't think we need that. And frankly, it's not going to solve the problem because, look, as you asked earlier in your question, what's the difference between manipulation and addiction and overuse? There are two kinds of manipulation. Manipulation is not, it tends to carry a negative connotation, but it's not necessarily a negative term because there are two kinds of manipulation. There is what we call persuasion, which is helping people do things they want to do, which is perfectly ethical. In fact, I think we should do more of that. We should use behavioral techniques, just like I wrote about in my book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. I didn't write that book for the social media companies. I stole their secrets so that entrepreneurs out there could use these tactics to persuade people. It's called persuasive design, to persuade them to do things they want to do. Exercise more, eat right, connect with loved ones, save money, be more productive at work. That's how we can use healthy habits. The same exact tactics that the social media companies use, the video game companies use, we can use to build good, healthy habits in people's lives. So that's persuasion. The opposite is coercion. Coercion is getting people to do things they don't want to do. That is a form of manipulation that is unethical. We would never want to get people to do something they don't want to do. Not only is that ethically immoral, it's also bad business. That these days, because of the internet, because of social media, because of reviews, if you get someone to do something, they didn't want to do, something they later regret, not only will they not do business with you anymore, they're going to tell all their friends on social media not to do business with you anymore. So it's bad business to coerce people. Now, of course, there's shysters out there, but they don't tend to stay in business for very long. So there's a big difference between persuasion, helping people do something they want to do, and coercion, getting them to do something that they don't want to do that they later regret.
Right, right. So as part of coercion, would you also say dark patterns are a part of it? Like say, for example, when I go to Amazon and I decide that I want to close the account once for all, but it's so very difficult to find the right place where I can go and close the account, and I cannot do it until I talk to an executive on their customer support team. So would that be part of that as well?
I think so, yeah. So it's all about that one word, regret. So if the user, knowing everything you know as the designer, still chose that action, then it's not coercion. Right. And so this is what I call the regret test. And I've written about this for years now, that I want companies to adopt this regret test as part of the process of building new products. That when there's a design pattern that is questionable, that may be coercive, we ask this question of, hey, would the user regret doing this behavior? So what you described is called the Roach Motel, because users come in and they never go out. It's like these old commercials we used to have about the Roach Motels, this insecticide where they, you know, the roaches go in, they die, they never come out. Well, that's kind of what this Roach Motel technique does, this dark pattern of when you sign up for a product and then you can never leave. I wrote an article recently calling out the New York Times, a publication that has published my work several times. I called them out because they use this Roach Motel technique. You sign up for the New York Times in seconds, but to cancel, it's like you described. I have to call an 800 number between the hours of 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I'm, you know, talked to for an hour and a half about why I shouldn't cancel. And it's a real pain. So it's easy to get in, hard to get out. That, I think, is an unethical business practice.
Right, right. And in this whole process, where does learned helplessness come into play? That's also something that's very close that I think I would love for you to go deep on.
Sure. So learned helplessness is this concept that when we think there's nothing to be done, we don't do anything about it. The classic study was done on elephants. Actually, I don't even know if it was a study. Maybe it's just part of folklore that apparently the way you train an elephant in a circus to be tied up with just a rope, you know, which the elephant could easily break, is that when the elephant is young, when it's a baby elephant, you chain the baby elephant with a rope that's strong. And then as the elephant gets bigger and bigger, they never test the rope again. Yeah. They just learned when the elephant was a baby that they're too weak and they never try ever again. And so that's why you can get a big you know, big elephant that could clearly rip the rope out, doesn't even try. It's called learned helplessness. So that phenomenon is something we see in people as well. That when it comes to alcoholics, for example, the number one characteristic of whether an alcoholic will stay sober after treatment is not their level of physical dependency. It is their belief in their own power to change. I mean, think about that for a minute. It's not what's happening in their blood. It's not the alcohol in their system. It's the belief in their mind. That's the number one determinant. And so when we tell people that technology is addicting them, that it's hijacking your brain, as Tristan Harris says, I think facetiously, what do people do? When you tell people that there's nothing you can do, that it's hijacking your brain, I mean, give me a break. You know, hijacking is what they did to us on 9/11. It's not Candy Crush, for God's sakes. But when you tell people this crap, they believe it. And what do? Nothing. I mean, if the social media companies wanted to get a message out, I think they'd make a movie like The Social Dilemma. Because The Social Dilemma tells you there's nothing you can do. Don't even try. The best you can do is, you know, call your politician. Yeah, right. Don't hold your breath. You're going to suffocate if we wait for them to do something about it. As opposed, you know, I was interviewed for The Social Dilemma movie. They talked to me for 3 hours and I gave them the solution. I told them, hey, look, yes, people can overuse these technologies. Some people even get addicted to these technologies. Here's what you can do about it. And I talked to them for 3 hours about all the things that people can do right now. We don't have to wait for the politicians. We don't have to wait for Zuckerberg to fix this problem. And you know how much of what I told them they put in the movie, what had taken me 5 years of research to do? Nothing.
Yeah.
They didn't put any of it in the movie. And frankly, it's not about me.
That does not fit the narrative.
Exactly. And which is so ironic because the movie is about the terrible filter bubbles online. And here's a movie, by the way, on Netflix that is one big filter bubble. They don't give even one. It's not about me. They didn't have anybody who disagreed with the central narrative in that movie. Not even one person. And so I think it is malpractice. It is like you go to a doctor and the doctor says, you know what? I'm so sorry. You have a terrible disease. And you say, oh my gosh, that's horrible news. Well, is there a cure? Well, yes, there is. Oh, fantastic. Can you give it to me? No. That's what The Social Dilemma did. Because even though the filmmakers knew the answers, I gave them the solutions. Anyone can become indistractable. We are so much more powerful than these technologies are. They didn't put any of that in the movie. None of it. And so that's what's leading to learned helplessness. The tech companies want people to believe the social dilemma narrative that there's nothing they can do about it because they know that if you believe it, that's exactly what you will do. Nothing.
Right, right. Absolutely loving this conversation. And, you know, as a next jump off point, let me also now take the role of being a marketer at a tech company, which I am, and ask you this. When we think of improving product adoption, you know, from the habit forming way and the product adoptions side of things, we tend to approach it very rationally in terms of thinking about product features, loyalty programs, and rarely do we think about the emotional aspect to create that stickiness that we are striving for. And do you think or have you seen instances in tech where a simple placebo button has made a world of a difference? And it would be great if you can share for our audience as to what placebo buttons are and how they help.
Okay, so placebo buttons are these things in our environment or in a user experience that make us feel better, whether they actually functionally do something or not. The classic example, the reason it's called a placebo button is that most elevators, the closed door function doesn't do anything.
Right.
That it's there for the fire brigade to use in emergency, and it only works when they put a key in the elevator, and then it works. So the vast majority of elevators, the closed door, open door thing doesn't do anything. But the open door does, but the closed door doesn't. But people push it because they want the doors to close faster because they're late for their meeting. So they push, and it doesn't do anything. We see this also in street signs that, you know, when it says push here for the walk signal, most of those don't work either, but they give you the feeling that you have some agency, some sense of control. Yeah. And so that's very powerful.
Even I think the road crossing button that you use.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the reason they do that is because if they didn't put a button there, if you didn't have some sense of agency, what people would do, unfortunately, is cross the street whenever they feel like it. They wouldn't wait for the signal to change. Most of those signals are timed, right? It's every 30 seconds. So if you just wait for 30 seconds, the signal will change, but people won't wait. They're impatient when they don't feel like they have agency. They don't feel like they have control. So by pushing the button, I feel like I'm making the light change faster. Well, you're not. It's on a timer, but it makes you feel like you're doing something.
Right.
And this sense of agency and control, by the way, is incredibly important. I mean, this is one of our fundamental core human needs, is a sense of agency.
Right. And do you see tech companies or tech products using this effectively in their platforms?
Well, you know, fundamentally, every product that we use, whether it's online, offline, doesn't matter if it's enterprise, consumer web, fundamentally, every product or service helps us change our mood. I mean, this is super important that as people who are building products, as entrepreneurs, as people who are looking to bring healthy habits into users' lives, we have to understand what people's internal triggers are. And internal triggers are these uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape from. That all human behavior is about the desire to escape discomfort. And so whether it's a need for control, agency, boredom, insecurity, fatigue, loneliness, stress, anxiety, all products and services, everything you use is fundamentally about manipulating our mood, about modulating whatever it is that we're feeling.
Right. So next, you know, let's also talk a little bit about gamification. Here's my view of it. Like, if gamification was to work all the time, then probably all the exercise/workout apps or maybe the referral systems or leaderboards should always work. But it doesn't. You know, the shiny aspect or what seems rewarding at times tends to be very temporary. Take Clubhouse, for example. I signed up for it 6 months back because I gave into the FOMO. It was back then iPhone only and it was invite only. For a couple of weeks, I probably enjoyed it, but then I felt I was wasting a lot of time. And this is where you talk about a minimal enjoyable action that not only helps in adoption, but for adoption over long periods of time. So, it'll be amazing if you can take us through what minimal enjoyable action is and how it works.
Sure. Yeah. So there's actually a lot there to discuss because there's a few points. But with the minimal enjoyable action, the idea is that when you have big steps, big initiatives in your life, you know, if when someone says, I want to lose weight, I want to write a book, I want to go get my degree, those huge goals sometimes can be debilitating because nobody writes a book. You write one word at a time, right? It doesn't all come out at once.
Absolutely.
You don't get in shape by just willing it to be by working out once real hard. You have to be diligent about it. You have to, one of my life mantras is consistency over intensity. Consistency over intensity. That good things in life take time. Rare things in life take time. It's about that diligent practice of doing that, small bits of action, relentless forward momentum day after day after day. And so a minimal enjoyable action helps you assess what level of exertion you still enjoy enough to keep doing it. Because again, consistency over intensity. So for example, when I started to run, okay, so I used to be clinically obese and
I cannot think of that.
No, this is true. And I always hated physical exercise, like always hated it. Because for me, for an obese person, exercise is horrible. At least for me, it was. It was sweaty and hard and not fun. I just never enjoyed it. But I knew it was something I wanted to do for my body, that one of my values is physical health. So I wanted to figure out not just how to do the exercise, but how to learn how to enjoy it enough to stay consistent with it. So I started with the minimal enjoyable action for me, the MIA, of walking. Okay, walking was something I always enjoyed. I could listen to a podcast. I could make a phone call. It was not that effortful. But for me, that was my MIA, just a walk. And so I put on my calendar 30 minutes to go on a walk. Great. And then one day I said, you know what? I'd really like to figure out what this whole running thing is about. Let me see if I can run. And I didn't say to myself, oh, I'm going to run for 30 minutes. No. I ran until it was no longer my MIA, which I'm embarrassed to say was maybe 30 seconds. I don't think I broke 30 seconds. Like I trotted for like 30 seconds and then I was like, this is not enjoyable anymore. So I went back to my MIA and I said, okay, let me just keep walking. And then the next time I went out, I think I hit 45 seconds. And you see where this is going, right? 45 seconds became a few minutes, became 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Well, today I run 4 miles straight and I enjoy it. I love running. And now that didn't happen overnight. It didn't even happen over the span of weeks. It took years. But it's something that I will have with me now for the rest of my life, that I no longer do it because I have to. I do it because I want to. And that is something that is enables me to do this behavior for the rest of my life.
You know, call it serendipity, because I started running 6 months back and I exactly went through the same process. I mean, I used to go to the gym and there were frequent lockdowns and I was like, hey, you know what? Exercising is not fun. It doesn't feel like every day at this time I go to the gym. It's not working out and I'm not doing anything. But then I started walking and now I run 5 kilometers every day.
Wonderful.
So it's yeah. like,
yeah. And if yeah. you love it, if it's something you really enjoy, you're not doing it for the health anymore, right? It doesn't even matter. Like, you know, honestly, if tomorrow there was a study that found, you know what, physical exercise, it doesn't do anything for you. You don't have to do it anymore. I think I would still run because now I actually enjoy it. And so that's much more sustainable yeah. than fighting yourself tooth and nail like I used to because I just hated the behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, that running time is also the time I listen to podcasts. So it's like fun. Absolutely.
Yep.
Right. So let's also talk a little bit about the indestructible aspect. You know, both your books came before the pandemic, but the arguments that you make in the book are far more relevant even now than when you wrote them. Since the beginning of 2020, all our lives have been circling around digital products like Zoom, Slack, email, what have you, which are supposed to help us collaborate and communicate better, but they are ending up blurring the lines between our work and personal life. And this is not just limited to knowledge workers like us, but even to my two kids at home who are pretty much spending 3 to 4 hours a day endlessly scrolling through the phone without much of intent. In fact, you opened your book with the anecdote of not being present with your daughter and how that moved you to write the book. So my question is to some extent, distraction becoming part of our life? The reason I ask this is, in all honesty, it's easier said than done to avoid distractions given in the world that we live in, no matter how aware you are of the issue.
Well, I think there's a big difference between a diversion and a distraction. That distraction is never good. Okay, distraction is defined as a behavior that moves you closer to what you said you were going to do. Things that move you closer to your values, help you become the kind of person you want to become.
Right.
So a distraction is something that takes you away from those things. The opposite of distraction, by the way, most people think it's focus. It's not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. That in fact, both words, traction and distraction, come from the same Latin root, trahare, which means to pull. And you'll notice, by the way, that traction and distraction also end in the same six letters, A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action. So by definition, is any action that pulls you towards what you said you were going to do, things that you do with intent. Anything that is not that, the opposite of traction, is distraction. Anything that pulls you away from what you said you were going to do. Anything that is not done with intent. So distraction is always bad. There's no such thing as a good distraction. What Right. there is a diversion. A diversion is simply a refocusing of attention. And diversion can be very healthy, right? There's nothing wrong with watching a movie to take our mind off of our life for a little bit, right?
Absolutely.
To escape into a book or a music or anything that you want to divert your attention away from can actually be very healthy. In fact, you know, when children have cancer, one of the treatment regimens for children with cancer while they're getting this very painful chemotherapy is to let them play specialized video games to divert their attention away from this painful treatment. It actually has been shown to be an analgesic. It reduces their pain very effectively. And so that's not a distraction because it's what is done with intent, which is why I really don't like this moralizing and medicalizing of, oh, technology is bad. You know, the technology, video games are evil. Come on, it's silly. Anything you do with intent, if you want to play video games, great, do it. If you want to pray, meditate, watch cricket, paint, I don't care. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is that you say you want to do with intent is up to you. Do it, but do it according to your values and according to your schedule, not someone else's. The time you plan to waste is not wasted time, as Dorothy Parker said. So we should stop moralizing and medicalizing the behaviors. It's not about the behaviors. It's about whether they are done with intent.
Absolutely, absolutely. Intent makes all the difference. Mm-hmm. All right, so as we are moving towards the 30-minute mark, it's time for us to rush into the next section of the podcast, which we call the rapid fire section. And in this section, I'm going to shoot 5 pointed questions at you. The questions might be short, but your answers need not be. You can go with the flow. And okay. Let me see if I can, you know, try my best to put you on the spot. So are you ready for that?
No, but let's do it anyway.
All right. So here's question number one. What's the story behind your website's name, Near and Far?
Oh, that's an easy one. So I grew up in a part of Central Florida where very few people had ever met people who weren't met, who didn't have the name Michael or John or Bill. I had a very unusual name. I was born in Israel and I left when I was 3 years old. But when I had to, you know, when people heard my name and I said my name is Near, then that sounds like, you know, my name is spelled N-I-R, but people thought I was saying N-E-A-R. And so they said, Near? You mean like near and far? And so that's kind of, I don't know, I guess kids used to make fun of me when and say that. It didn't really bother me, but that kind of, I wanted to use that as a way to help people understand how to pronounce my name, because people oftentimes will pronounce it Ner or something else, some other variation. So I made my website Near and Far to help people understand how to pronounce my first name, N-I-R.
That's absolutely amazing. I love this. And you know, in this pandemic time, your name also helps because you're near everyone in their ears and yet so far.
Ah, there you go. Appreciate it. Sometimes people ask me if it's short for anything, and nope, it's not. Just N-I-R, Near.
Love it. All right, so here's question number two. You say that the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yes, absolutely. So this is really the summary. If you wanted to condense my book into one phrase, I think it's this. The antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. That procrastination, distraction, these are not moral failings. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, people think that somehow they're broken. There's nothing wrong with them. They're perfectly wonderful people. It's just that we haven't learned how to deal with our impulses. That's fundamentally what procrastination, distraction is all about. It's simply learning to deal with our impulses. And we frankly haven't been taught how to deal with those impulses in a healthy way that lead us towards traction rather than distraction. So the lesson here is that the antidote to impulsiveness, if all these problems are simply caused by our inability to deal with our impulses, then the antidote is forethought. What do I mean by that? You know, our species has an amazing evolutionary gift, is that we can see the future. We can predict what is going to happen better than any other species on Earth. Right? We can see what will happen with higher fidelity than any other animal that walks the earth.
Right.
So that means that we can take steps today to prevent getting distracted tomorrow. That if you leave it up to the last minute, you will lose. If you wait till the chocolate cake is on the fork, you're going to eat it. If you wait till the cigarette is in your hand, you're going to smoke it. If you sleep next to your cell phone every night, of course, it's going to be the first thing you reach for before you even say hello to your loved one. So you cannot wait till the last minute. If you do, they will get you. And you have no one to blame but yourself. Because the way to fight distraction, the way to live the kind of life we know we deserve, is to not wait till the last minute, is to use forethought. Because I'm telling you, there's no algorithm. There's no, you know, secret. I wrote the book on how these companies get you hooked. I will tell you, I know all their tricks, and they are powerless against your ability to think ahead, to use forethought, to make plans today so that you will not get distracted tomorrow.
Wow, that's amazing. I absolutely love this. All right, so here's question number three, and this is more of a fun question. Which is the most engaging piece of software that you use regularly, almost on a daily basis?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me, I'll tell you. So I love this app called Pocket. It's an app where, so I have a rule ever since writing Indistractable that I never read articles on my computer desktop. Yeah. Because they are designed, you know, whether it's the BBC or Al Jazeera or New York Times, it doesn't matter. All these companies have one incentive, and it's the same incentive as Facebook, by the way, or any other media company. They want to sell your eyeballs to their advertisers. That's how they make money. Yep. So they make these clickbaity headlines to keep you reading and scrolling and reading and scrolling. They don't care if you're well-informed. They just want to keep you on their news sites. So I have a rule. I don't read any content on my desktop. If I see an article that I'm interested in, I send it to this app called Pocket that's on my phone. And there's a little Chrome extension on my browser. So with one button, it's on my phone. And it scrubs out all those clickbaity headlines, all the advertisements, all the links are gone. And the beauty of this app is that it will actually read to you with this text-to-speech function. It will read these articles to you. And so I use this technique called temptation bundling to listen to these articles while I'm doing something else, for example, while I'm exercising. So it becomes almost part of the reward for getting, you know, going to the gym or taking a walk is that I get to listen to these articles. So I use Pocket, oh my gosh, probably hundreds of times a day.
That's amazing. And you know, the fun fact about Pocket is that it also does the other side where you can also pay them to send out an email campaign to the millions of subscribers and it reaches your inbox as well.
I didn't know that. I need to check that out. I need to try that. Have you used it before?
Yeah, I've used it in one of my previous companies to do a huge mail blast when I was doing a product release.
Was it effective?
Not much. In fact, it was not a very focused audience, so it was not really helpful.
Oh, okay. Well, at least the articles are good.
Yeah. All right. So here's question number four. Except for Hooked and Indistractable, what's a book or any other form of content that you would recommend our listeners to check out if they want to learn more about behavior design?
So it's not especially focused on behavioral design, but I think it's a book everyone should read, which is called Factfulness by Hans Rosling, who recently passed away a couple of years ago. But it's a tremendous book. Have you read Factfulness?
No, I haven't. I haven't even heard, so I'm going to check it out.
Oh, it's great. I highly recommend it, Factfulness. And it's basically a book about reality, a book about what's really going on in the world. Basically, what this researcher did is he had he gave a test to academics. I can't remember how many thousands of academics, you know, PhDs, very, very smart people, asking them about the state of the world. And it was things like, you know, how many countries are democratic? What is the state of healthcare around the world? Education levels, female empowerment, all kinds of questions, the state of the environment, all kinds of questions about the state of the world. You know, these are very, very highly educated people. And he found that they scored worse than if he had given the test to a bunch of monkeys who were picking at random. Because it turns out that we have endemic to most people, the vast majority of us, what's called a negativity bias, that we believe that reality is what we see on the news. But of course, the news is only there to show you the bad stuff because they know the bad stuff is what keeps you watching. And so most of us think that the world is getting worse. And of course, the exact opposite is actually occurring, that in almost every way, the state of the world is getting better. And so he goes fact by fact by fact. It's just such a brilliant book. You will not see reality the same way after you read this book.
Wow. I'm definitely going to check that out. And I love your example because, you know, David Cancel was on the show a couple of months back and he said that he had so much of fun and so much, he became so much more productive the moment he went on a, you know, news fast or a news detox.
Yeah, there is something to that. I'm not quite to that extreme. I do consume the news. I sometimes don't like everything I read, and sometimes I probably read too much, which is when I have to dial it back, but I make time for it in my schedule so that it doesn't bleed over into other things. I like the news, but it's very important to have a balanced media diet. And especially it's important to read the mainstream media, knowing what their incentives are. That their incentives, you know, nobody writes in a paper, hey, there were no airplane crashes again today. Like, that's not news. Nobody tells you, like, you know, millions of people were lifted out of poverty today. You know, that's not news, but it's amazing. But we don't hear about it because no paper has the incentive to write about it. They only write about the bad stuff, the scary things, because that's what people will read. So it's very important to know their incentives every day when we consume this media diet and to fill it in with other forms of media that that are maybe better for our brain as well. And I can't advocate enough to read books, right? Daily deluge of what's happening in the headlines is just not that important. What's really important are the time-honored lessons. You know, when someone spends 5 years on a book like I did, there's going to be some wisdom there. At least I hope. I think, you know, the process certainly changed my life of writing this book and has benefited me tremendously. And there's so many books out there. You know, buying a book is probably the highest ROI thing you could possibly do with your money and your time, because it's condensed wisdom. As opposed to, you know, the daily headlines are you know, cranked out by some journalists who are paid to just write a bunch of words as quickly as they can to get the most reaction, the most clicks that they possibly can.
Yeah, absolutely. And every good book with a lot of research doesn't start with "What's my angle?" You know.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, love this. All right, so here's the final rapid fire question: what's a productivity hack that you follow daily to avoid getting distracted?
So it's not a hack per se, but it's really this four-part model that's the core of becoming indistractable. We talked about the difference between traction and distraction. We got into a little bit around internal triggers and external triggers. Internal triggers are all these uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape from. And external triggers are all the things around us, the pings, dings, and rings that can lead towards distraction. So it's really four key steps. There is no one magic bullet. I know people always want the life hacks and tips and tricks, but if you just use the life hacks, it doesn't last for very long. What you really need to do is to understand not just the tactics. The tactics are what you do. Strategy is why you do it. So why we get distracted is because of these four parts of traction, distraction, internal triggers, external triggers. So we can turn those into solutions. Number one, master the internal triggers. If you don't master your internal triggers, they will become your masters. Step number two is to make time for traction. We have to plan our day or somebody's going to plan it for us. Number three, hack back the external triggers. We have to ask ourselves which external triggers are serving us and which are we serving. And finally, number four, preventing distraction with pacts. A pact is a pre-commitment. It's a promise that we make in advance to make sure we don't go off track. It's the last line of defense. It's something we do after we've used the other four techniques. And it's with these tactics in concert, this is how we become indistractable.
Wow, I'm loving this. And all of this in many ways also connects with that Mia aspect when you search for, you know, what's working for you.
Yeah. So one of the misconceptions is that you have to do everything all right away. And that's not the case. That's not my philosophy at all. Yeah. That if you just do one simple thing from each of these four parts, right? Master internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, and prevent distraction with packs. If you do one small thing, you will immediately see results and you will start your way on this path to become more indistractable. So everybody gets distracted from time to time. It's part of the human condition. I still get distracted from time to time. Becoming indistractable doesn't mean you never get distracted. It means you understand why you got distracted and you prevent that same distraction from happening again. So if I get distracted by something once, okay, well, you know, sucks. But if I get distracted by the same thing again and again, now it's my fault. It's like Paulo Coelho has a wonderful quote. He said,
yeah.
A mistake repeated more than once is a decision.
A decision. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So most people, you know, how much can we complain about Facebook and Twitter and WhatsApp and Snapchat? Like, really? How are we going to keep complaining about this forever? Do something about it. How about turning off your stupid notifications that buzz you every 5 minutes? Why don't you start with that? So if we just complain about it and don't do anything about it, we are deciding to be distractible. Whereas an indistractable person says, okay, you got me once, but you're not going to get me again because I now know why I got distracted. I'm going to take steps right now to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Wow, this is amazing. You know what, Nir? I could hear you all day. I absolutely love
that's
this.
That's not what my wife says. You should.
But you know what? You really hit all the rapid fire questions out of the park. That's amazing.
My pleasure.
Right. So before I, thank you and let you go, let me ask you this. Like, our listeners are predominantly B2B SaaS marketers and salespeople with about 5+ years of experience around the globe. So would you like to share a parting message to them?
You know, I think that we underappreciate the kind of work we do. You know, I mean, I know that we're all rewarded by our, there's economic incentives, there's the joy of accomplishing a goal you've set out. But I want people out there to know that technology is important for our species survival, right? That is what has always increased standards of living. It's always been the technological innovators. And I know, many of us, I work this mundane job, how am I having an impact on the world? Look, if you are making a product that improves people's lives, you are helping the world. You are making the world better, not just for yourself and for your family, but for your customers, for the economic value you're creating in the world, that is an important job, that we need more people to get excited about technology, not to think, oh, it's just these shysters in Silicon Valley. No, that would be terrible. Let's not have that kind of cynical attitude. We want to believe in the promise of technology to make the future better.
Wow, that's an amazing message. And if the listeners of the podcast, if they want to get in touch with you, what's the best place and what are the best reasons to connect with you for?
Sure thing. So if you go to my website, as we talked about earlier, nearandfar.com, near is spelled like my first name. So that's nirandfar.com. There's actually an 80-page workbook from Indistractable that we couldn't fit into the final edition of the book because it got too long. So it's made available for you complimentary. Just go to nearandfar.com and you can download it on my site.
Amazing. And thank you so much once again, Nir. I loved everything that you said. And these 45 minutes went like it was just about five. So I absolutely love this. Thank you so much for taking out time and talking to us.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. So to the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us in this episode. And until we connect with you the next time with another guest and another topic, this is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.